We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Man, do we have a treat for you all this week. We are joined by the 14th undisputed world chess champion, the man who toppled the mighty Kasparov, one of the top 10 highest chess-rated players of all time. In 1996, he became the youngest player ever to become the world's highest-rated player. That record was only broken 14 years later by a gentleman named Magnus Carlsen. He has won way more tournaments than I can name. And as luck would have it, he is out with a brand new Chessable course called Thinking in Chess, a how-to guide, which I have really been enjoying digging into in the lead up to this interview. So we'll be discussing his career and his course and his recent no-castling match with Grandmaster Viswanathan Anand and so much more. So let's welcome him to the show, Grandmaster Vladimir Kramnik. Thank you for joining us.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone. The introduction was rather long, and it sounds like I'm a patriarch, a legend. In fact, okay, I was always playing chess, and I never had any really. I never thought that it's going to be as successful as you call it. I'm not even sure if it was. But if you say so, probably you're right. the most important, I always enjoy it.
Well, to hear you say that you thought it wouldn't be as successful, I was planning on talking about the match with Anand first, but it makes me wonder. So if we think back to the first Olympiad where you were only an FM and Kasparov and the Russian team selected you to join the Olympiad, and then you, of course, historically had just an amazing performance in that Olympiad, how did it feel to be selected? Were you shocked, and did you feel like you belonged at that time?
Oh, I was completely shocked. Of course, I didn't feel that I belonged. Actually, now I understand Barry, and if I would be in his position, I would also give it a try, because now I understand that I was a very good player already. Yeah, but as at that time, I was not aware of it. I mean, I thought I'm kind of talented young guy who is trying still to get to learn something about chess, and then all of a sudden, not even being a grandmaster. I mean, for me, it was, I didn't expect it at all. When I remember during the closing ceremony of the Dortmund tournament, where Gary was also playing, but he played in the main tournament, 1992. I won the Open, he won the main tournament. It was a very strong Open with many strong grandmasters. And I just made my third GM norm. So, okay, just finally I got it. I was very happy about it. At least I will one day become a grandmaster, and that is a title nobody is going to take away from me. So already, like, one of the goals I had from the childhood is fulfilled. So, and then all of a sudden, the trainer of our national team, Grandmaster Razubayev, he came to me during the closing ceremony, and then he said that he wants to talk to me, and yeah, he told me that they want to have me in the national men's team. I mean, for me, I was totally puzzled. Of course, I said yes, but I think I just asked him if he's sure that this is the right thing. But he said, yeah, Gary is also approved. So it's like we both think it's a good choice. So I said, okay, if you think so, I'm ready. I'm ready to serve.
And then, of course, you had a 2900 performance rating. So I guess you were ready.
Yes, I was not sure about it. But, you know, I actually always play chess and like this. And especially when you are young, I think it's more even normal, yeah? I never thought of the, you know, of the result of what am I good enough, not good enough. I just come and play. Yeah, I like playing. I try, and okay, if I'm good enough, okay, surprise, pleasant surprise. If not, well, what to do? It means I have to work more, or maybe even I'm simply not good enough in general. So I always took it easy. I mean, yeah, that was maybe my strong point. That in a certain sense, yeah. I mean, of course, if you are very determined about your result, about your very concrete goals, it also gives you energy and the push and so on. But from other point of view, it makes you tremble, so to say, in the right moment. I never cared. Okay, if I lose, I lose. If I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough. That's it. Yeah. I mean, so that's why, yeah, I actually came there. I just played. I absolutely didn't know what to expect, whether I will be playing well, showing good result, or maybe total disaster will come. Okay, I just played, and I realized that I'm probably somewhere in the middle of the tournament, because I started 6 out of 6. So I realized that probably I'm ready for this level already.
Right. Well, that's amazing to hear. Now, hearing you talk about, okay, you just showed up and just played, and maybe that attitude was part of what enabled you to have all the success that you subsequently had. And you talk in your Chessable course memorably about what a big influence Karpov was on you and how that was the only book you had as a kid. But I'm curious, Vladimir, how hard were you working on your chess away from the board? I mean, you love the game, you played a lot, but were you reading for hour after hour, or was it more of a sort of casual, I don't know if casual is the right word, but less rigid approach?
It was not hard. I mean, even if it was a lot, maybe, yeah, time-wise, but it was not hard because I liked it. I mean, that's very important. Yeah, I remember as a kid, I mean, nobody ever, my parents never forced me to study chess. I mean, which, by the way, happened with some other players, I know. But with me, I was forcing them to buy me books and so on. So I always enjoy it, and when you like it, when you find it interesting, it takes you, then, especially as a kid or young man, you have lots of energy, so you can work for hours, and I have never, first of all, had a routine in my work. I mean, never had a kind of plan, you know, how many hours should I work today or tomorrow, and also I never really checked the time, I mean, when I was working. I don't know how much I was working. Maybe 3 hours a day, maybe 6. I didn't notice the time. Yeah. I was just working. So in this sense, I was lucky maybe because I liked the game. This is a very important. I mean, really liked it in the sense, not only the result, which of course everybody wants to be successful in what he's doing, but I actually like the process. Also, strangely enough, the process of analyzing, working on chess, not only playing, but also working. And so then when you like what you do, time runs much faster and things are going much easier. That's what I think.
And it's amazing to hear that perspective. And I'm sure some people wish that they could feel the same way, because some people, they love chess and they work hard on it, but they do try to have to measure the time. But I mean, it's amazing to hear that you sort of describe yourself as like just a little boy lost, enjoying what he's doing, and then obviously eventually become a man, which we've got a ton of questions from Patreon supporters of the podcast. So I'm going to try to cover a lot of topics in the time that we have, Vladimir. So I'd like to bring it forward to the no castling match with Grandmaster Viswanathan Anand, which of course recently concluded. You guys played 4 games. He beat you in the first game, and the last 3 games were draws. What was your overall impression? Well, I guess, sorry, I should explain just for any listeners who aren't familiar before I get to the question. So Vladimir has been at the forefront of suggesting new chess variants that can be played. And one of the ones that he deemed possibly the best was no castling chess. And of course, this was in collaboration with DeepMind, the creators of AlphaZero, who used their program to test all these variants and see which ones led to the most sporting chess. So here we are, and these two legends played each other in a match using a game, the same rules as regular chess, except you're not allowed to castle. So Vladimir, what was your impression of this match and of no castling chess as you got to play it under match conditions?
Yeah, first of all, it was an experiment for me. I mean, not that I care so much about the result, because I'm not playing chess professionally anyways anymore. But I wanted to try it myself. I already had a very clear idea about it, because when we started with DeepMind, and we even published a big scientific study on it, like 100 pages. And it was just one of the possible variants. And I already understood that it's very interesting. But playing it, yeah, it was good. I think it fully met my expectations. I think it's a very interesting variant of chess, one of a few interesting variants. Everybody can play it as well. So I should maybe talk a bit about how did I start this whole project, if you want. Yeah,
that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, the main idea was that, of course, chess is a great game, and it's incredibly rich and interesting game. But as a professional chess player, and believe me, I'm by far not the only one, I started to feel, especially when engines were getting stronger and stronger, that on the high professional level, it's becoming more and more difficult actually to get a game. So the content, so to say, there is much less content in a game. It's not a problem or fault of professional chess players, but simply that many openings are deeply analyzed, and it's very difficult not only to get an advantage with white, that's already end of a story, it's already clear that there is no advantage, I mean, that it's objectively a drawish game, but also simply to find a way how to pose at least some practical problems for the opponents. And we see it quite often in top events that quite some games are just finishing basically. Basically, there is not much content in the game. Yeah. A lot of time now in your preparation is needed just for very mechanical work, like analyzing, so to say, pushing the button and then memorizing all those computer variations, and after that trying to repeat them before games, like 2-3 hours. Every top player knows that he needs to spend a couple of hours before each game just to repeat these lines, just not to forget, because if you forget and your opponent remembers, then you're done in a sharp position very often. And all this is basically quite often is finally, in order to come there and to make all the best moves from your computer, your opponent is doing the same. And then maybe you make a few more moves, but basically it's already clear that the game ends in a draw, and have a draw and to prepare for the next game, which will very possibly go into the same scenario. So somehow I got it. Yeah, I think chess is not about it, not about that. I'm only talking about a very top professional level. I mean, where really the knowledge and the level of players is so high that, it's actually difficult to find any way to play your opponent sometimes. Yeah. So, yeah, that came to this. I came to certain ideas how to change chess a little bit. I mean, especially considering quite a significant success of Fischer Random Chess. Then I thought, so it's clear that people, they want more content, yeah, spectators also, they want more content into the game. Yeah, that actually, I started to think about ideas, what can be done that we, let's say, top chess players, can start to play as early as possible. Yeah, I mean, to take out this all unnecessary theory, because basically, yeah, and to make the game longer in a way. Yeah, so players start to play on their own from as early as possible. So which would definitely finally lead to more decisive games. And actually, simply the most important is not even draws. So the most important is content. Yeah, that there is more games with real content. And that was one of the variations, and we have another few interesting variations, and we checked it with DeepMind, with this company. We made quite some work trying to make the AlphaZero analyze it, play games and so on, because it's also very important when you're trying a new variation of chess to be sure that the balance of the game is still there. Because, for instance, in Fischer Random, there are some positions where in which white's advantage is almost decisive starting positions, yeah, objectively, because of position of pieces. So what was important is to see, first of all, aesthetically how the games are going, and also if the final balance of the game is there, and it's practically the same, I mean, more or less equal game, yeah, maybe 51-49 for white as in standard chess, but all this theory is going away, and it's not going to be very soon before, I think, tens of years before it gets to the level of modern chess theory. Because it's about patterns, and all patterns are different. So even if computer will tell you what is the best move according to computer, it's still you don't get it. Yeah, you don't understand what to do in an equal position, which arises. I mean, in a standard chess, every top chess player, he knows by heart exactly where to put pieces, what kind of pieces to exchange, I mean, what to do. In this type of game, it's absolutely unknown territory, and you have to start creating from yourself, yeah, and by yourself. And so I saw the games between AlphaZero playing itself, and they were extremely entertaining. I mean, they were really fantastic, very entertaining. So I got excited and I tried. We played the match with Vishu, and I think also the games were very interesting, all four games. And that is happening quite rarely nowadays on the top level. Finally, we actually had three draws, although normally, of course, there should be more resulting games. It was more accident, but that is not important. It's not about the result, it's about the content of the games. But I believe everybody who wants to check these games, they will find. Yeah, the all four games were very hard fought and a lot of original ideas, tactics, attacks, counterattacks. I mean, I think it's very interesting chess. But I mean, again, my idea, the last thing I want to say is not to remove classical chess. Of course not. It's just to give an opportunity, you know, a little bit slightly different variation, which actually is chess. In fact, it is chess because I want to say, by the way, I went through the history of the game, and actually the castle didn't exist. I mean, it's quite a late invention in chess. There was no castle in chess yet. So I have my certain ideas why they installed this rule. But actually the original chess castle was not there, yeah, was not existing. But anyways, yes, yeah, so it's still chess, but it requires much more creativity and depth of thought and from chess players, and you start to play much earlier, to play really, not to perform the computer preparation moves, but really to play chess. And I like it. I mean, again, it's for everyone to decide. It's just, I personally like it. I wanted to give this to the chess community, and if they like it, okay, if one day they all like to play it like this, no castle or other variants, great. If not, there is nothing wrong with standard chess either.
Yeah, we had a question from a Patreon supporter of the podcast, Kartik Tadapalli, which I think you basically just answered, which is, will game modes like no castling chess really change the game? So it sounds like you're suggesting that's not for you to decide, but it's just another option.
Well, you see, again, what is good about it, I also thought that it can be actually introduced in regular tournaments, you know, because the world of chess is very, well, we must admit, very conservative, yeah? But, you know, if you are looking at many sports like volleyball, football, there are always some small adjustments to the rules. I mean, you know it all the time. Ice hockey, I mean, most of sports, there are some adjustments all the time. So, and in chess, for some reason, we have this idea that the smallest adjustment is a crime. Yeah, it's like a betrayal of the game. But actually, it is not. It doesn't change anything. The game is still the same. So that's why I think that we can at least try it. And also, it is a way to avoid opening theory. I mean, make actually top-level events much more entertaining for public. And I am afraid, what is my fear, and it's, I think, justified. I'm quite a qualified person. Seeing how engines and theory develop, that actually it's a matter of time when basically it will be almost impossible to win a game against a very top player if he doesn't want to risk. Yeah, basically. And that actually has quite dangerous consequences. So before we are there, and I'm sure we will be there, it's a matter of time only. Before we are there, I think it's better maybe to try to take some measures and to secure that chess will still be interesting and public will not move away from this game. Beautiful game and go watch something else because there are just too many draws or no content. And just the last thing, it takes a lot of time, but my answer. But the last thing, because what struck me at some point, I started to think about it. You know the game of checkers, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, but when was the last time you've seen something in media about checkers?
Yeah, never. I mean, I can't. As a chess player, it's only when we're talking about Ivanchuk or something.
Yeah. But in general, in media, there is nothing about checkers. But it's a fantastic game. It's a great game. As a kid, I liked it also. Why? And before, I remember in the 90s, I always saw something about checkers. Not much, but still, it was existing in the media field. But the last time I remember my own experience, the last time I've seen something about checkers was a report about the World Championship match in checkers, where basically it was already such a level of players that basically they're making all draws. There was simply no decisive game. So usually World Championship matches would come like 16 draws, then another 4 draws in a rapid chess, and then maybe somebody wins in blitz, yeah? And that would decide the title. And, okay, then you see the problem is that checkers is a game which used to be at least liked a lot by public, by, you know, it's played in many, you know, in many families. It's a very nice game, especially for kids, but it's almost disappeared, basically. It's like almost dead, the game. It's very sad for me. And I'm sure that this is the reason, because people just lost interest when you know, you see that, you know, it's there is not much going on in the level, yeah, that all games are ending in a draw. I mean, we are still far from it, definitely, chess, but I don't want to end up in the same way, and that is one of the reasons why I decided to spend time on this project.
Excellent. Well, I agree, the games were quite entertaining, and it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. And I know you've mentioned in interviews that you're talking mainly about the professional level. It's not necessarily that at the amateur level we play badly enough that there can still be plenty of mistakes and decisive results. And as you say, it's not just about decisive results, but entertaining games. But yeah, at the professional level, I see what you're saying. And that gets into...
But you see, because as in checkers happen, what I mean that unfortunately, what happens in professional level can really damage amateur level, like with checkers. Yeah, there are much less people playing checkers now at home because there is much media support of checkers. And finally, you know, it goes to all levels. And of course, for chess, although any player he wants, he can play without castle. I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, of any level. But yeah, there is definitely no problem at all playing a regular chess, obviously. But I'm afraid that it will go, you know, up, down. Yeah, I mean, it can happen. Sorry.
That's a good. No, that's fine. And that's a good insight. So we're going to take a quick break, Vladimir, and then I'd like to hear more of your thoughts on computer chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. If you haven't checked out aimchess.com by now, what are you waiting for? What aimchess does is it collects your games from the major chess sites and then gives you actionable advice of how to improve your game. It might be to work on a specific opening or to get better at end games or improve your time management or whatever it may be. And then it gives you related puzzles to help you improve that specific skill. They are constantly improving the site. They recently added blindfold tactics, time management training, common checkmate patterns. So there's so much to do there. If you decide to subscribe, be sure to use the promo code PERPETUAL30. Details are in the show notes for aimchess.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So we are back, and we are going to dive into the next question from the Patreon mailbag. I'm going to try to power through these. So this question is from Craig Mallon and does relate to computer chess and the future of chess. And he asks, to what extent have the games of AlphaZero and other AI engines influenced your play? Do you feel like the ideas and styles of those programs are transferable to human chess? So really two separate questions there.
Well, definitely it has a huge influence. It made a huge influence, not only negative, which I consider negative, which is just, you know, learning lots of forced variations and trying to memorize them. But also positive, which is definitely it opened new dimensions of understanding of the game for chess play. Definitely the chess players understand game with, in this computer era, stronger and stronger computers, I mean, engines become, I mean, they bring, they, you know, explain us, so to say, a lot. And of course, the understanding of chess is broadening from human players. So there is a positive side of it. Also, one rather positive side is that nowadays every amateur, he can follow games with the engine, and then he or she can understand what is going on. Yeah, I mean, in some way. I mean, that you know, that if you're just sitting home and there is no engine, something is going on, and if your level is not professional, it's quite difficult to understand what's going on. Here you can have an understanding who is better and so on, what was a mistake. From the point of view, it has also negative sides, but in general, yeah, there are lots of positive things. And about did it change the game of human players? Definitely, yes. Definitely.
Okay. And of course, you're well known for the influence that your own game has had on opening theory in particular. I know that Peter Hein-Nielsen and Grandmaster Jan Gustafsson, they've done a series on the top 50 players of all time, and they were talking about your outsized influence, of course, with the Berlin defense and the Catalan and many other openings. And of course, now computers are kind of confirming what you found. So we had a question from Tyron Ross Price, another supporter of the podcast. And Tyron asks, who do you credit with influencing or helping you in advancing your opening understanding? So when you came up with this stuff, most notably the Berlin, of course, in the match against Kasparov, were computers involved or was it just your own sort of grunt work?
No, computers were very weak at that time. I can tell you they were actually disturbing me. Yeah. I mean, they were discouraging because at that time, I can tell you, I remember, let's say there was the best program was Fritz, if I remember well, and it would assess the position after queen takes d8, king takes d8, beginning of this Berlin endgame as almost plus one for white. So it would, you know, it would say that actually it's simply unplayable, basically. But I felt it shouldn't be. I had a clear feeling that the endgame is at least not so bad. So I was fighting against the computer in a way. I was trying to fight the computer and to prove my concept. So no, computers didn't help all in it. And actually, what is funny, I've read it and it was kind of more funny. I mean, I don't have problems with ego or something, so it was more fun episode that actually when I learned that AlphaZero, after many, many hours and getting higher and higher level, finally it decided that Berlin is the best best opening choice against E4, of all. So fine, now on the highest level, it actually plays Berlin all the time because it considers it the best opening, which is also, I mean, I'm sure the other rule opens even which are as good as Berlin. So it's very general. But what I mean, why? Yeah, it was my specialty. I don't know. Everybody has his talent, you know, some specialty, special talent in chess. And maybe mine was this. I like, you know, what is very important. I think it's a big difference compared to maybe many other even top level players, that I always considered opening work as a kind of creative work. So for me, working on openings was not, was the idea was not to build a practical repertoire which I will use to win games. Yeah, it was not only this, by far not that. It was more just that I want to understand chess. I want to learn chess. So it was interesting for me in itself. And that's why when you have this approach, then you are trying to invent new things, because it's kind of boring just to repeat the best moves after Kasparov or Karpov and just to build repertoire, hope in them. I found it boring. So I always try to find my own ways. And as I, since I've mentioned already that I liked also working on chess, then it came together, and that it probably helped me to find quite a number of, reconsider or even to reopen quite a number of openings, so different opening lines, which are still staying there, and with years, which proved to be really still good, like Sveshnikov, Petrov also, and so on. So, yeah, it happened like this, but probably that was the reason.
And you and Richardson, of course, you had a team of grandmasters helping you in your match against Kasparov. Did how much did they help with the Berlin in particular? And do you remember, was it your idea? Just looking for a little more info on that.
Yeah, definitely it was my idea. Yeah, I mean, I always felt that I haven't played it that time. I played Petrov and Sveshnikov, Rauser. But I always had a feeling looking at this Berlin endgame that it shouldn't be too bad. I don't know. I don't understand why it's bad. Yeah, because there are two bishops and, endgame. I mean, it was kind of, I have the feeling that I never touched the opening. Actually, then I understood why I had this feeling. I think it's an optical mistake in a way. What I mean is that because when you look at this position after, let's say, you change on d8, king takes d8, then you play king e8, as usually people used to play. I mean, the problem is that in your mind, you're a bit confused because the big difference is black cannot castle. And usually with king on e8, you can castle. So basically, it looks much better than it is, because, of course, if black wouldn't be able to castle, then he would be just slightly better in this endgame. But you know, when you look at it, it's not so deeply in your mind because you think that you can castle. Yes, so that somehow I always was curious why it's considered to be such a dubious opening. So then I understood that things are not so easy when I started working on it because you cannot castle, and it makes it a bit more troublesome, the situation, but still, I felt like still, even I was going against the machine, which would say that, and I think that was also a trap which maybe Gary fell into, because I'm sure that he was repeating and repeating this Berlin, because mainly computer was just saying that it's better for white, and it's very principal line, and it's objectively better, yeah, according to machine. But then, okay, bad luck for Gary, computers were wrong. They can be wrong. I think they still can be wrong, and especially at that time. So you shouldn't have trusted machine maybe too much, at least back then. But yeah, it was my own idea because then I just, when I came, I mean, that was for me pretty clear that especially for the match against Paris, it's the best choice, just because also because of the style, you know, I was always quite a strong endgame player. And Gary was, of course, strong in every field, but it was not his best, you know. I mean, of course, also very strong in endgames, but clearly he had even stronger points, yeah. So I felt like, okay, it should, it's a good surprise. It's kind of surprise weapon. It's maybe not as bad as it looks, and it fits my match strategy. So for me, frankly, was absolutely no doubt that it's a good choice, unless it's really bad. You know, it's like there is a clear way for white to get an advantage. And that's why when I started working on it, when I just understood that at least it's not so clear. I mean, I understood that things are not so rosy. It's not so easy to equalize either, but there is no obvious way for white to get an advantage. I mean, it's a very complicated, strange position. And that for me, there was no doubt that I'm going to play it.
You've got a lot of amazing insights there that I'd like to follow up on. Number one is with Kasparov. So you mentioned that maybe he was following the machine too much and he was unable to find an edge. But there was also some sort of strange, he had a decent number of short draws with white after you got off to an early lead. Do you have any theory on what happened there? Do you think that you got in his head, or what do you think happened to make that transpire?
Well, because first of all, I think he lost a bit of confidence, obviously, which is normal. Everybody would, yeah, if the situation, you know, it's the first time this match. It somehow started very well for me. If you remember, I won the second game rather convincingly. And I mean, let's say after four games or six games, whatever, I also actually missed wins in fourth and sixth game with white. So actually the score was not too bad. It was just minus one for Gary. But I think that's what I think now that looking back, that actually what was more difficult to hold, I mean, more difficult to take for him was that actually, and then maybe this was the first time in all his World Championship matches, that let's say after six games, he's playing worse. You know, I mean, it's not that he's just minus one accidentally. That's not a problem. You can always win game. But actually, he feels like he's inferior in this particular match. I mean, I don't play in general. And that is a very difficult feeling to take, especially from such a player who is absolutely not used to this. Yeah, that shake his confidence. And also, yes, he started to be very, 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 cautious. But of course, quite a lot of short draws he was making just because he couldn't get anything out of the opening. And then when the position was equal, I think it was in a way right decision because, you know, in this situation in the match when you're minus one, actually, not losing a second game is more important than winning a game because minus two situation becomes really dramatic. And minus one, especially since he had draws in the match, yeah, so in case if it was 8-8, he would keep the title. It's almost nothing, so you can always get your chance. But when you're minus two already, it's really becoming very critical. Yeah, so I think he is a very experienced match player. He understood it, and he didn't want to take too much risk before, you know, before the last games of the match. So, so there are some quite logical explanations. There is nothing mystical in it. Or you shouldn't search for some, you know, outside of chess explanations. I think it was pretty normal and also quite expected from me. I mean, I knew he's not going to take much risk before, so, but then he lost the game 10, and then already he was going all in, and actually it was put a lot of pressure on me in the last part of the match.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't have any crazy outside theories, but I did think that maybe since Kasparov sort of had anointed you in the 90s, as we mentioned with the Olympiad team. And then, of course, you worked with him in the 95 match with Anand, which I want to circle back to. So I thought that maybe because he had sort of felt all along that maybe you were going to be the person that would topple him, that when you got an early lead, there was like a sense of fatalism that maybe set in.
Well, this sense of fatalism can be. But again, I think he respected me a lot as a chess player, maybe even too much. Actually, because I always thought that, for instance, Visha Anand is not worse than me at all in any sense. Yeah, but for some reason, between two of us, he always like somehow was valuing me. I could feel higher a bit. Yeah, for no particular reason, frankly. But of course, it's not only this, but yeah, sometimes it's you never know what is going on in your head, and you have Somehow he felt like, I always, when I played him, even in the 90s, he was never so confident as playing with other players. I noticed it, strangely enough, because even before the match, we had quite a few games when, as white, he made short draws with me. I mean, just played the opening, there was nothing special, and then he would just offer a draw or something, you know. So he had a lot of respect. So it was, I think his game, besides, of course, he's absolutely brilliant chess player and his chess is phenomenal, but also a big part of it maybe was this kind of confidence, yeah, and you know, kind of destroying the confidence of your opponent. And probably he felt in a way that, I mean, he cannot destroy my confidence because I don't have any. There is nothing to do. I just come there and play chess, and for me, you know, always playing Gary or other a great players was, it was a fantastic opportunity. You know, I always was very happy when playing Gary. Why to fear? I mean, I know he's great. He's better than me, let's say, in the 90s especially. And, okay, if I lose, I lose. But I have such an opportunity to play with a great player and to learn from him and to try my best, you know. So I was always, I never had even a shade of fear or, you know, something. And that was maybe something quite unusual because most of players, you know, they still maybe care a bit more about result, or they have this idea about how strong is your opponent. I actually never had it in my life. I can open you a secret. I never cared. I mean, okay, even if my opponent is stronger than me, but in one particular game, I am good enough to win one particular game always, yeah, against any player, any color, in one particular game. So why not this game will be exactly that one? So that was my understanding. Okay, maybe he's better than me, but I have my chance and I'm just trying to use it. And if not, hey, he's better than me, he wins. Congratulations, great. So that's why maybe it was a very kind of, special, unusual approach. And he didn't feel this, this psychological advantage, which he usually had and felt probably, during games with other players. And that also was maybe shaking a bit his confidence and making him not kind of uncomfortable, but was a little bit out of his normal routine in a way playing me. That's my one of possible explanations. But first of all, he knows better himself if he would ever tell it, of course. I don't know, but in any case, it is as it is, yeah. So, I can tell you last thing about it is that all players, they have the minotaurs, yeah, the kind of the nemesis, it calls, yeah. The players who are very difficult to play with for no special reason, yeah. You just play badly against this player. I have mine as well, and every top player has such a guy in his pocket who is not better maybe than some others, but for some reason, especially against him, you are doing badly for some reason. And it's like fate, you know. You just cannot do anything about it. I mean, you can still win games from time to time, but all in all, it's a very difficult opponent for you. And I felt that Gary, it was from the very beginning, because I managed to beat him already when I was 17, you know. Actually, at some point, I won 3 games against him in a matter of 5 months. 3 games, you know. I mean, he was usually losing maybe 2-3 a year. And he lost to me when, I think, in 94, was it? Yeah, in 94, so I was just 18. So he lost 3 times again. So it's like, yeah, and maybe it was also something which shook his confidence somehow, yeah. Because somehow he felt that, I'm this kind of guy who is for some mystical reason, he cannot find keys, for some reason.
Okay. Well, thanks for those amazing insights. Yeah. And just one more thing tangentially related to this topic. When you mentioned the fact that you sort of overrode the computer evaluation in your assessment of the Berlin against Kasparov and mentioned that it's still important today, I wondered, is there anyone that you notice in the modern game who has a tendency to sort of look deeper than the engine and find creative opening ideas?
Well, now it's becoming more and more difficult, and that's why I came up with those variants of chess, because computers are far, way stronger than at the time, and almost always correct, in a way, if you just push the button, yeah? But the point is that, you know, I think, I see that not everyone, maybe not even more than, not even the majority, even of top players, especially young, they understand that it's not about so much the objective assessment of the computer, you know. So, you know, okay, equal, if it's equal, it's still a game. Finally, you have to play a game. And if the position is not comfortable for you, if you don't feel comfortable, so to say, you better play slightly worse position, but which you feel, which you like in a way, which suits your style and you feel comfortable with, then completely equal, but you somehow don't know what to do in this position. And that element is very important, I believe. And I see that, for instance, Magnus, he understands it very well, and he is very careful about it, I'm sure. But most of, especially very young players, for them, actually, the goal of their preparation and chess analysis is to achieve 0-0 with black or 0.1 with white. And that is that means good preparation. But even when I give some sessions to talented young kids, I always explain them that it's not the goal, not the goal at all of your preparation. Yeah, the goal is of course, not to get too bad position out of the opening, but finally to get the feeling of the coming position in the middle games, because from some point on you will have to play it over the board. And who cares if it's equal according to computer, who can make calculate variations 50 moves ahead and make 10 only moves without any problem? I mean, we humans cannot. So you know, you have to understand that if you are a positional player, probably it's one story is equal in Queen's Gambit, another story is 0-0 in a sharp, I don't know, neither. It's totally different story, yeah? So that's why, those kind of small things are still, I think, missing in preparation of especially young players. They sometimes don't get this, you know, this feeling, and that's why old, so to say, old experienced players like Magnus, I can even clearly see how well he's using it. So so they say that he's not really playing for open advantage. No, it's not this. He's playing for middle game advantage. Yeah. So he tries to get those 0-0, which are especially good against this particular opponent, because he knows that he is not going to play it as well. And against other guy, he would go to another 0-0 position. But because he understands, I think, very well this idea that basically, you know, it's about your type of position, your style, your abilities as a chess player, and not about additional 0.1 according to Stockfish. You know, that is not so important for the outcome of the game.
Okay, great insights. Thank you. And Vladimir, we're going to take one more break to hear from our sponsors, and then I'd like to talk about your great new Chessable course. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for its proprietary move trainer technology, which utilizes space repetition to quiz you and make sure that you remember whatever tactical patterns or opening sequences that you're working on. They have a huge catalog of great books from top flight authors, both for purchase. And if you check for their short and sweet courses, you can find tons of free content. Speaking of free content, Chessable, of course, has also recently launched an adult improvement focused chess podcast called How to Chess, with yours truly hosting it. Check for it on Chessable's YouTube channel, and you can also subscribe on the podcast platforms.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And we are back, and the course, of course, is called Thinking in Chess, a How-To Guide. In the introduction, Vladimir says, and I quote, "I would like to share with you my vision of positional play, my personal decision-making method, and many more things. In a word, to share with you my chess zen." And as I mentioned in the introduction, I've been really enjoying the course. Obviously, for one of the best players of all time, the material is going to be reasonably high level. Vladimir does explain things in a way that I think is accessible to all levels. But in terms of finding the moves, I, as a 2100 player, did not have a very high batting average, I have to admit. Although when he explained it, I learned a lot. So Vladimir, could you explain a little bit about, actually, I'll ask you, Dima Spivak's question. So thanks for supporting the podcast, Dima. And Dima wrote in to ask you, what is it about quiet moves and the less flashy parts of chess strategy that appealed to you enough to make it the topic of your first Chessable course?
So first of all, what I want to say that it's don't worry if you didn't find all the best moves in those examples I was given in this course, because most of the games were games of mine, and most of the times my opponents, top chess players, also made mistakes. They didn't find the best move. So,
right.
So those training is really for very, very high level chess players. I mean, if you find even half of the best of the right answers from those positions, you are probably 26 plus player. So it's not you know, my idea was not to not to make it a sportive competition. I mean, what is important that I want to invite all listeners of this course to think about the position, to try to find solution, because they're very complex, they're very deep, very subtle often, with a lot of ideas. I mean, it's not like solving a mate in five, yeah? It's much more complex. So basically what I wanted is that people who are listening to this course, in the meantime, because I give a lot of explanations and my vision of different positions, of different elements of chess, that in the meantime, they also have a training, you know, that it's like interactive, that they don't just listen, because I really believe you need to train also at the same time. But again, I tell you that it's a very difficult subject. My examples are complex, complicated, and subtle, so don't worry if you don't manage to solve them. Why is this course? Well, first of all, I've finished playing professional chess, and I have time now, and I would like to share, you know, certain, you know, throughout the professional chess career, a lot of years, I worked a lot on chess, but also I thought a lot about chess, yeah. I mean, trying to conceptualize, to structurize in my mind certain elements of the game. I won one thing, for instance, which I'm totally convinced. Basically, you know, the thing is that, again, there are no kind of, you know, huge discoveries. That, okay, I found a way how to play chess. No. It's there are no secrets. It's not there are no big secrets. It's not something you can understand and then you just beat everyone, become world champion. It's a long process, getting better in chess. But anyway, what I think is important sometimes is to speak it out, so to say, so to structureize in your mind something which you actually do subconsciously, you know, without being aware of it. Yeah, but I always thought that it's very helpful to get the awareness of it. So in a way, to put all this thinking process into words, you know, that you actually know what you are doing, actually, yeah, that you are aware of your process, and then. First of all, it helps you to improve a lot. And secondly, it helps you to, so to say, to cure some problems, yeah, if you have, because you actually kind of understand the path. You know, once you understand the path, how you got to a wrong solution, then maybe it's easier to find that part of the chain which is broken, which was broken there. Yeah. So in a way, it is this, and why is this element, especially prophylactic chess, I would say, because it's the most difficult to believe in. It is the most important. The most important because, as I mentioned in this course. I believe that once you start to think about it, actually, practically the whole game, what you are doing is that, you know, you're trying to understand what your opponent wants to do. And actually, your move and vice versa, the move of your opponent is always a reaction of the move of the other player. And basically, it very much depends most of the time on which exactly move he made and what he wants to do next. So that's why I always had this kind of prophylactic thinking in essence. Yeah, I mean that one of my main messages which I try to deliver in this course, as simple as it sounds maybe, but it is very important to get it deep into your mind, you know, if you want to improve in chess, that actually chess is a prophylactic game in itself, that understanding and preventing the plans of your opponent or the threats of your opponent is actually more important than realizing your own plans, because it's much more difficult, And that is what, and I'm showing lots of examples, and in some of them you can see that it's like this fight is going on every single move for 20 moves in a row. Every single move is actually both players are fighting against plans or ideas of the opponent. And of course, that is, well, one of the most difficult elements in chess, I believe, to master. But improving in this element, independently on your level, yeah, whatever level you are, will pay off more than in any other element of chess. Because that is something which is happening every time, I mean, many times in each game, when actually you're trying to understand what your opponent wants and trying to prevent and so on. I mean, otherwise you can, of course, study opening. That's all good and it's necessary. But you know, then this opening might not appear on the board. You can study some combination or some beautiful attacks, but position, it's Queen's Gambit and position is very quiet. Yeah, but almost every game, every day you play chess, you are facing this this element of chess, is trying to go deep into the position to understand the strategic points of the position and to understand what your opponent wants to do, how exactly, and then to coordinate your play, your plan with having this in mind. So I believe it's a core of the game of chess, and easy to say, of course, but difficult to realize is to explain how, yeah, because it's something very subtle, very, you know, difficult to structureize it in a mathematical way. But I tried, and I'm giving a lot of examples. So if you want, during this course, I tried to explain how I see the position, why I play this move. I mean, going very deep into the position, and maybe for many listeners it would feel like it's too complicated, but in fact, you know, shouldn't be too worried about it, because the main idea is to get the feel, to get the feeling, because everybody will do it in his own level. Then you improve, then you do it on the better level. Still not perfect, because nobody is perfect. Then you improve again. Then you get to the next level, you know, like in all other elements of chess. But this is the core of the game, as I've mentioned already. And it's important to start with a solid base. And what I want to present is a solid base. I want to show this in full depth, what kind of problems top players and their kind of, I guess, for club players of amateurs, sort of a goal, yeah, to achieve. So a certain authority. Yeah? So what top players are thinking about in such situation? What kind of questions do they raise? Do they ask themselves? And what kind of answers do they give to those questions? And finally, this whole path from the beginning to the to the best move or to the certain understanding the position and realizing a certain plan. So I'm trying to give this pass in many, many hours. And I believe it should be very useful in any case. I mean, in any case, somebody will understand maybe more, somebody a bit less. But I think it's useful for any level because last thing I wanted to tell, because by my own experience, I've been in the, when I was 12, I was invited to Botvinnik Kasparov School. Actually, it was the best school for best juniors in Soviet Union at that time. And we actually, it was not such a big deal in a way. I mean, we just had two sessions, 10 days, sessions a year, 10-day session. And we would just analyze some games. There was no material. They were not teaching us anything. Botvinnik and Kasparov, they were present there. And they would simply analyze games and just tell their opinions, you know, about certain positions. And I can tell you that that was much more, so to say, profitable than any amount of books I've ever read. Because it's about, you know, understanding how a top player at the time, Gary was world champion, how do they think? I mean, how do they see the position? What kind of plans do they try to realize? And that is something which stays in your subconsciousness, if you want. And you just play better all of a sudden. Yeah. And even the last thing, even when I was already a top 10 player, I remember my first Linares 1993. It was my first top tournament. It was actually Karpov, Kasparov were playing there. I would say out of top 10 players, there were 9. So it was really, really top player, top tournament. And I was just 17, I think, was it? Yeah, I was just 17. Good old days. Actually, I was already number 8 in the world, and I made +2 there. I mean, I had a good result. But I would still, because at that time we had a nice tradition, there were no computers yet, and there was an analysis room where the players, after their games, they would analyze games with each other. And I remember I tried to use any opportunity if I would finish game earlier than Kasparov and Karpov especially. I would just come there, join the analysis, and just sit and listen. How they analyze the game? Because, I mean, it was so incredibly interesting and so fruitful because I just, you know, it was so interesting to see how do they assess the situation, what kind of variations do they see during the game, you know, and then so somehow it's because it is so kind of this kind of non-direct learning. But I believe and I strongly believe that this type of learning is the most efficient, is really priceless when you learn without noticing that you are learning. Yeah. And even when you don't understand something, what the player is saying, I mean, let's say Gary, when I was at his school, I mean, I was not understanding it very often, really, yeah. But all of a sudden, I would realize that in half a year in a tournament, I would actually start to do better in some. I start to become better in some elements of chess, and without me notice, just because it just went there somewhere. You know, all those words are getting there, some work is going on, and then you become better. And sometimes you feel like you didn't really get it, what he meant. But in fact, you play some game, couple of, and I'm also telling about it in the introduction of this course, and then you realize, it got there. I mean, you didn't notice, but actually you are a much better player in this element of chess all of a sudden, and it's clear by statistics, by your games. And so that's why I believe from this course, there are a lot of course, concrete things which I want to tell and which hopefully are very useful for for the player of almost any level. Well, maybe not Magnus, only not, or other top players. But also there is a lot of indirect learning which you can do, which I am a big fan of, because that was, I believe, analyzing nowadays my career, I believe that was the core of my success is much more of this indirect learning than direct learning.
That's interesting. And I have a follow-up question about that, but I just want to say that I sprung for the video version of this course, and I definitely, and regular listeners to the podcast will know that often I'm more of a prose type person. I prefer reading. But for this in particular, I think that seeing you explain things is really important. And as you mentioned, it is challenging material, but that's all the more reason as I'll be watching the videos multiple times for sure. I mean, it's just great to see how you break down the thinking process?
Well, the problem is that, yeah, just before you ask the question, I mean, the problem that the thematic is very difficult. I mean, it is a challenge. I mean, it's a very ambitious project because it's not like, you know, how to make the king. Then it's extremely entertaining. Yeah, you show, look, it's some beautiful combination. Everybody understands how it goes, but probably you learn much less from it. Yeah, as they say, no pain, no gain. So here it's more complex. And I would be not sincere, and I think it wouldn't be efficient if I would present it in a very light way, like, you know, in a very simple way, because it will you will not learn much if you make it too simple. Just that simple, that because it's not simple. I mean, let's be fair, let's be frank. Yeah, it is a difficult, but again, improving there is extremely important. And so that's why prepare for work, you know, for really try, I mean, for a mental effort. It's really a mental effort to try to understand all those subtle details, which I'm trying to tell you, but I believe that it will pay off very, you know, enormously. So sorry, yeah, please ask your question.
Oh, no, of course. So the last major topic I wanted to discuss, Vladimir, of course, is the upcoming World Championship. I'm sure whether on the record or off the record, you've been asked about this a fair amount, but I'm sure our listeners would like to hear. So how do you assess the match between Carlsen and Nepomniachtchi?
It's different. First of all, I do not follow, you know, like daily chess nowadays. So I see some games and... I wouldn't say that you should probably ask this question more to someone who is still involved daily, so to say, in top professional level chess. But all in all, you know, again, in World Championship matches, a priori, both players are, you know, very strong. So it's very much, actually, a lot depends on the shape you manage to get into the match. I mean, let's say assessing chances half year before, 1 year before, is very general, you know. I mean, you need to see the latest shape, the latest, you know, trends, how players are playing. And especially what I usually like to do is to assess it more after two or maximum four games when the match is played. Then I feel that I can judge already who is in what form and what to expect. But if you want a very, very general assessment, okay, what I see now, I might be wrong, of course, but I'm sincere. I believe, so to say, so far, the tendency is not in Magnus' favor. I mean, I would say that if after candidates, I'm totally honest with you, I thought he's a quite, well, significant favorite, 60-40 I was assessing. Now I assess 50-50. If it continues like this, I think, I would say Nepo would be a favorite. I mean, by the beginning of the match, 60-40, I would say. Because I think that the trend is not in his favor now. Because I think, it's my opinion, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but I think that Nepo, he improved a lot in I see, since candidates. I saw his last rapid tournaments, and it's really good. I mean, he's really playing better than candidates. Because frankly, again, I'm sincere. I think that his candidate's play, I was not very, very impressed by his play. By result, yes, by play, no. But now he's really playing better. I mean, now he's a really serious force. And again, being honest with you, I think that with Magnus, the tendency is other way around. I think that, I mean, of course, his skill level is very high, but I believe that, yes, his play deteriorated last year. I mean, pure play, I don't talk about results, in my personal opinion. And so it's like two trains which are going, in opposite, and somehow it's like one is going like this, another going like this. And maybe even if started here, but they're already here, you know, and if the trend continues, it can get there. You see what I mean? So if I would be Magnus, I would very seriously think on how to change this trend. Because, if he does it, he would still be a favorite. If not, it can end not well for him. That's my opinion. But might be very original and a bit abstract. But I'm check the games and Franklin Magnus play, I start to see a certain mistakes which I've never was doing before. Of course, it's still fantastic level. I mean, Magnus is a genius. It's absolutely true. But I see some very, very, you know, dangerous for him things happening. And okay, if he managed to get rid of it, it's one story. But it's been already for some time, and it's not easy when it takes a long time, you know, to change the trend. Of course, he's capable. He's an absolutely magnificent player. Yeah, but for now, I would say that. So at this moment of time, I would consider chances as completely equal. At this moment of time.
That's fascinating. And we should say for listeners, we're recording this on July 28th. It's and the World Cup has just reached the final eight. So the form that Magnus shows in these subsequent matches could alter this assessment, of course. It's a fluid situation, but I appreciate your insights.
Yeah, that was, by the way, based on this event, because my personal, again, maybe people will be feel that I'm biased. I'm not actually, or feel that I'm too harsh, but I think that I'm not convinced with his play in the World Cup so far, and it's kind of. But there is a very important Stavanger tournament. I believe that would be very interesting for me and for others probably to see, because I guess it's 10 games or something, and it's maybe the last big tournament before the World Championship match, and it'll be very interesting to see. What kind of, you know, form and how the play will change of both players, because they both are playing there. But for now, it seems to me that, as I told, that there's never clear improvement, clear, absolutely clear, I can see. It doesn't mean that it will continue going up and up, but it's already much better than half a year ago with Magnus. I don't see it, to put it mildly. So it's a bit, again, probably other top players would have a totally different opinion about it. There is nobody right or wrong. I just express my opinion. Maybe I'm
wrong. I'd love to hear it.
I'm professional. I've been there for a while. So it at least has some value, my opinion. But, don't take it as the ultimate.
And a related question from supporter of the podcast, Cody Noble. Cody wrote in to ask, he said, in a recent interview, you mentioned that your championship years were not your most pleasant or happy years. And after losing the title, things seem to be back on track for you. How different is it to be the world chess champion as opposed to being a super GM? What are the drawbacks to being the world champion that you experienced?
Well, there are two points. First of all, it depends on the character. I mean, I'm not a character who was searching for fame, for glory, or for public attention. It's just not my type of a person. So for people who are happy, I mean, who like it, who likes it, and there are some, for them, probably it gives an additional push, you know, being a world champion. For me, it was more of a minus, but mainly the we have to consider the situation there. I mean, it's totally different to what is now. Yeah, now there are clear cycle. Everything is clear according to the rules.
Right.
When I became world champion, it was such a total mess with different titles, with different FIDE classical, with a lot of fights, a lot of intrigues. Frankly, lots of forces fighting against me personally. So it was not a funny world championship, I would say, period. Yeah, in this sense, it was extremely interesting. And I'm frankly, even if my watch from the chess point of view, there were good moments, but it could have been better, my world championship period. But I'm very happy with what I managed to achieve, the unification, and finally that we came back to a normal cycle when everything is clear, everything is according to the rules. I really set this goal for me and met a lot of had a lot of problems because of it, because it was not really to everyone's taste, let's put it this way. But finally, what I see now is something which I personally wanted to see when I became world champion. And whether, of course, it was not fully my it was But maybe some part of it, of this success, that in my opinion, we have a successful, quiet, clear standard world championship. Everything, everybody knows what he's doing, when, and everything goes according to the rules. For maybe young audience, I have to mention that it was by far not the case at that time, and you can check of historical materials on it. So, So, I mean, for nowadays world champions, it's, of course, definitely easier. So maybe if I would have been world champion now, maybe it would have been less difficult than at that time. But at that time, it was quite something with a lot of, you know, strange things happening when I was thrown out of the world championship, when I, even at some point, my rating was, from the rating list. There were quite some stories. I was very uncompromising in my position, and that was causing some reactions from different sources. So it was tough time, but good times. I mean, all in all, I'm very happy that I had this experience, but I don't wish any world champions like Magnus now, maybe some in future, to go through all this again. I hope it will not be needed anymore.
Okay, excellent insights. Vladimir, we're over time. I have three more questions, I think, from the Patreon mailbag. Would you be okay?
Sure.
Awesome.
Sure.
Thanks so much. So the first one is from David Lazarus, who asks, he says, do you believe it's possible for players past their 60th birthday to compete in the top echelon of chess right now?
I mean, what do you mean by top echelon? Become world champion? Definitely not. Being in top 20? No, probably not. Top 100? Yes, probably. No, because after all, chess is also, you know, it's not only about knowing how to, where to put your piece. It's about being able to do it physically.
Right.
No, what I mean that, chess is a game of concentration also, you know, and the game of chess requires a long ability to concentrate in a long period of time, and that is becoming more and more of an issue with age. I mean, that is a problem. It's also, of course, health, some other priorities, you have kids, family, that's also, but the main point is that everybody with age starts to experience some more and more concentration lapse, because you just all of a sudden, you know, your physics, whatever, your, you know, nerve system, maybe who knows what, but it doesn't hold it so well anymore. So from time to time, you just start to make blunders. I mean, terrible blunders, which, and I started to notice it after 40 myself, and just absolutely, which has nothing to do with chess, with your level. It just at some point you switch off for a few minutes, and then you switch on, but it's too late. And when it starts, usually it happens more and more often, then it's just difficult to compensate, because it's like you're giving handicap to your younger opponents, who are also very strong. You're like giving 2 points from the beginning of the day. You know that there will be one or two games when you just totally lose concentration at some point, and will probably just blunder. And they will not. So at the beginning, you're -2 with others. It's very difficult to compete. So, I mean, those things, but you can still play on the high level, of course. I mean, as I think Vasily Smyslov once put it, he said that, once somebody learns how to play chess well, he will not unlearn. He will not, he will not forget it. But then it's also about performing, and performing, it's also sports. It's not only a game, it's sports, and it's also very demanding, even physically. So that's why, I feel now, I think my understanding is still, on the high level. Theoretically, I can fight with almost anyone now, but practically, I just don't have the energy and the concentration for it.
Yeah, makes sense. And on a related question, Joe Salmon wrote in to ask, what are your thoughts on last year's Legends of Chess? Now, that was a invitational tournament with lots of legends of the game like yourself, Peter Lecoq, Boris Gelfand, Peter Svidler, Ivanchuk, as well top players like Magnus and Anish.
It was a great tournament. I really liked it. I mean, it was very tough because 9 days in a row, it's not easy, of course, at our age, but it was a great event. I would love to participate again once, in such an event. But of course, it requires, I would need to prepare even physically and to hold this tension. But actually, for me, I think was very interesting event. The only problem, I mean, again, don't take it as an excuse, but it's just true that actually it was quite a bad circumstances for me, because it was, I think, in July or August, yeah, I think, was played.
Yeah, I'd have
it was
to check.
In July, yeah. And, you know, it was exactly the biggest hit we had, you know, in Switzerland. And in Switzerland, you cannot have actually air conditions at home inside the apartment because of this, you know, it pollutes the air or something. So basically, you know, it was like every day 30, 35. And yeah, I was, frankly, you know, I was very often taking shower in between games because just, you know, I was sitting with a towel nearby me. So from time to time, I would, you know, take away sweat and then just run to a shower to take a quick shower before the second, the next game. So it was a little bit difficult on top of very strong opponents and, of course, me already not playing at the level I used to play. Even though I actually had good chances to qualify for the last four, I didn't manage. But all in all, I enjoyed it. It was difficult, of course, but I enjoyed it and I would love to repeat it. I think it's a very interesting event. I mean, I think many people want to see the grandpas like me and Vishy, you know, our generation fighting even with each other and with young players, because I think that in a short term, in one tournament, you know, if we are prepared and if it's not we physically hold it, we can still manage it. Of course, in the long run, it's difficult, but during the whole year. But I think it's this clash of generation. I hope Chess24 will make once again this tournament, because I think it was a success.
Yeah, I agree. I would love to see it again. It's always fun to see the older guys get out there. And a question from Timothy Ha, who's Timothy says, I've seen some of my businessman friends sharing posts on social media about playing Kramnik in private simuls in Russia. Have you faced any good master level players there? And also, what do you think of amateurs, people with full time jobs other than chess, spending time studying the game and playing in tournaments? What kind of chess improvement can they be looking for if they will never become grandmasters or even titled players?
For the first question, yes, sometimes I do such exhibitions. By the way, by far, not only in Russia, in other countries also, I do sometimes. And sometimes you realize that there are some very good chess players, I mean, who are prominent figures in other areas, but they really love chess and they are quite good at chess, actually. I have a few friends who are, well, quite big level businessmen and so on, and they're actually like 2,200, 2,300 level players. So, yeah, that's but for me, you know, when I give a simultaneous, it's more like a social kind of exchange. It's, you know, I think that people, they like it, and I like to, you know, to give them this chance to meet me, to play a game, to communicate, and to spend a good time and maybe memorable time for them. So that's more of a social event than really competitive. Yeah. And about the second question, again, I think we spoke about it at the very beginning of our podcast, but it's about what do you want from chess? Yeah, I mean, chess is not as life in general, but let's talk about chess. It's not about winning, making points, money, I don't know, rating. It's not that. The essence of it is you need to enjoy it. Yeah, you like it. And it's, of course, everybody wants to improve. Top players, professional players, but also amateurs. But and they would improve, I mean, as much if they work on chess and so on. But at the end of the day, it's not the goal, in fact. Yeah, the goal is a process. Yeah, the process of enjoying, of feeling that you find some nice combination in your, you know, even 5 minutes game on internet, it's a pleasure. Yeah, you won a nice game against an opponent who is higher rated than you. You enjoy it. You study a certain combination. You like it. That's the main point of the game, you know. So a little bit, you know, nowadays world is a bit too fixated on numbers. Yeah, I in my opinion, I'm very conservative old fashioned in this sense. You know, I mean, numbers are numbers. I never cared, what am I standing, you know, in the history of chess, or what is my rating, 10 best, 20 best, I don't care. So, I mean, it's not the point. The point is that if you like it, if you enjoy it, I mean, just do it. I mean, that's why you need to do it, because it's a nice thing to do. It also, you know, it's a good exercise for brain. it's healthy, you know, not traumatic, and and at the yeah. same time, if you enjoy it, that is the main thing, you know. So everybody has different ceilings, so to say, yeah. And also, it very much depends on how much time you have. Yeah. Some people have more time to study, some less. So again, if you study one, only have time for 2 hours a week, you will not achieve grandmaster level anyways. It's just not possible. Yeah, I wouldn't as well if I would be studying, you know, 1 hour a week. So you should not think about it then. But I think what is in general very pleasant for everyone is to try to feel that you understood something. You are a little bit at least better players than 1 week ago, yeah, 1 month ago. And that is already something. And then just leave it and see what happens. You like it, you feel like you're improving at least a little bit very often. I mean, and then just let's see. That was my attitude from the early age. And you see, sometimes it can happen that the ceiling is pretty high, as in my case. You know, you never know.
Yeah.
Before you start. So I would not advise to set some goals, especially for non-professional players. So, okay, now in 1 month I want this rating, in 2 months I want this title, I don't know, feed the master, just forget, relax. I mean, enjoy chess, improve, and it comes. And if it doesn't come, it's okay also. Yeah, it's not the end of the day. At least you enjoy it, what you are doing.
Amazing advice there. Yeah, I think that's a great point. And one last question. Of course, you mentioned, as we said earlier in the course, you mentioned the influence that Karpov had on you. And Cody Noble also noticed that and wrote in to ask. He said he watched an interview where you mentioned the player that had the most influence on you growing up was former world champion Anatoly Karpov, due to his best games collection being the only chess book you had. He was, of course, an absolute star in Soviet Russia. So Cody wonders what it was like for you to get to play him for the first time and whether you had met him prior to this encounter.
Yes, no, of course. But also I learned a lot from Kasparov and other players, Fischer and so on. But just that Karpov was my first. Yeah, I mean, it was my first book was on Karpov. So of course that was the most, maybe, you know, most memorable. And also it builds you in a way, your vision of chess. Yeah, so it just happened accidentally. It's not that Karpov is better than Kasparov or worse. No, I mean, again, I don't like these definitions. Better, worse, a genius, a fantastic player's boss. So, you know, who cares who is, you know, who has more rating or so on. It just happened like this. But then I've learned from other players, especially I was in Kasparov school, so I've learned a lot from him as well. And with Karpov, yes, and then the first time I played with him, but, you know, I was already a strong player, so it was not like... Actually, I played with Gary for the first time when I was 12 in a simul. He was given a simul to the, I think it was 5 boards or something, to the pupils of the school. And I played my first game with Gary. I lost it with black. And then I made a draw with white on the next simul, the next session of our school. So actually, I met him. Yeah, I played with him when I was 12. Yeah, that was much more memorable because that for me was really amazing. You know, at the age of 12, playing with Kasparov in a simul, but in a real, not like 20 boards, but with blocks, you know, it's serious simul, yeah. So, but with Karpov, yeah, remember it was exactly with Linares 1993. And yeah, it was kind of, I remember very well this feeling. Okay, I was already doing well. I made a draw with Kasparov and I was, I think, on +1. Actually, I think we played in penultimate round of this tournament. And Karpov was in the second place, I think, after Kasparov. Kasparov won the tournament. And then, yeah, of course, I mean, I knew Karpov is an amazing player in general, and especially in end games, in positional play. I was black, and we played some opening. It went very quickly to an end game, kind of a little bit better for him. He was playing white, equal, you know, not something like that. Yeah, and then, you know, all of a sudden, I totally outplayed him. And actually, it was for me such a shock. I mean, I somehow, I was not, I never had too much ego, you know, in the sense that I was quite modest. You know, I never felt like I'm a great player already or something. So that actually made me feel that since he's not a bad player still, you know, actually next year he made this famous 10 and a half out of 13. Yeah. So he was clear second in the world. And I managed to outplay him completely in the quiet endgame. So I got the winning position. Then the game was adjourned after 60 moves. It was still adjournment. The last, I think, big tournament I played with adjournment. And then it was probably winning, but he had drawing chances in a very interesting endgame, which I analyzed the whole night. But then he was defending incredibly, just finding all the time only moves during the next day. And I was probably a bit tired because I had barely slept. And finally, he managed to save it. I think like it was more than 100 moves. So, but in a way, it was a very memorable game. I think there is on the internet even a photo of us playing this game. And of course, from one point of view, disappointing because I should have won, and I was winning at some point already by force. From other point of view, it was an incredible lesson, and also I was proud that I could actually, not only fight, but actually almost beat such a player with black at the time. But also a good lesson of how well such players they defend. For me it was amazing because I never yet faced such a level of resistance. It seems lost, but it's finding only moves all the time. It just doesn't let me win by force. During like 40 moves in a row, and one day you make a mistake. So it was a very instructive, very memorable game for me. That's true. But then we played a lot, and finally, okay, not as much as with Gary. Of course, I played much more with Gary, but with Karpov we played, classical, maybe like 15 games, something like that, I think. And finally, we had equal score. We won twice each, and the rest were draws. But then he already got older, and he kind of retired from chess. But yeah, it was, of course, the first one by far was the most memorable. Yeah, I remember very well, even analyzing this endgame at night in my room, the whole night. Even I remember exactly the endgame, actually. So, yeah, that was...
Wow. And did you talk to him after the game much?
Of course, because he... at some point, because when finally he managed to make a draw... And he just immediately, when we agreed to a draw, he pointed out at some point that I could win just immediately by force. He said, if you would play this move, I was going to stop the clock. And actually I was probably just tired because it was a very simple trick because, okay, I thought it doesn't work because of something. And then I just missed a very simple trick, of course, I saw this move. It was the most natural. So actually he kind of, put the salt on my
right, you wouldn't, yeah.
But yeah, and when telling that actually if you would play this, which of course was my first kind of, he was going to stop the clock. but in any case, yeah, it was of course all such things, meetings with top players, with such great players, listening to them, playing against them, it's all in all, it's priceless, yeah, because they teach you. Even if they don't want to teach you, even it's not their intention, but actually they do. If you have the ability to learn, if you have this kind of mind which swallows this kind of lesson, which understands, what is going on, what was your mistake, and so on, so they teach you better than anyone else. Yeah. So in this sense, even one game was extremely educational.
Amazing. All right. I swear this is the last question, but sure. Hearing you say that made me remember you, of course, as we mentioned earlier, worked with Kasparov in 1995 for his match with Anand. And Nepomniachtchi has worked with Carlsen a bit in 2012 and 2013. So hearing you talk about what you absorbed from people made me remember, do you feel like it gave you a competitive advantage in the match that you'd been on the inside seeing Kasparov prepare? And do you think that that might be the case for Nepo as well?
No, the competitive advantage, if any, there is no objective competitive advantage because I think he have learned more from about me than I learned from him because actually I was, showing him some lines, analyzing for him. So, but obviously he was just busy, having with the other task, which was at that time more important, defending his title. But... finally, it's about who learns more. From it, yeah. There's no objectivity, but in any case, we shouldn't overestimate this this kind of understanding, working together, understanding a player. Because especially if we're talking about Nepo and Magnus, it's been almost 10 years ago. They're totally different players already. Chess have changed a lot. Right. So, okay, you can maybe, if you're more like refined in the sense, you have better feel for it. Yeah, maybe you can draw certain general conclusions about the player. But first of all, very general. And secondly, it can also be misleading because a player and a person can change a lot since then. And you might maybe base your preparation or base your ideas how to play against him if you are doing it based on the your experience 10 years ago. You can actually make a big mistake because you can all of a sudden come to a match and face a totally different human being and a player. And so I don't think it is, I think you can learn much more by deeply analyzing games of your opponent during the last 2-3 years. That gives you much more information than. But as to Garian, that time, yeah, I'm not sure it gave me too much of advantage, or actually that I drew so many conclusions out of it. No, I mean, what it really helped me is to understand how to work, you know. I mean, the intensity of work and the depths of it, yeah, that was something new to me, and that gave me a lot. And actually, just half a year after working with Gary for this match, I became number one in the world. I mean, I just raised like 30, 40 yellow points in half year because somehow, but not because I was using zero openings, because actually all openings were not part of my repertoire. So there was nothing I used opening wise, but just, you know, I understood something about the working process in general. Not necessarily for the World Championship match, but in general, the discipline and the intensity of work, that was really very profitable for me to learn. Yeah, but but I don't think it made any really big effect on the result of the match finally with Gary 5 years after.
Okay. Good to know. And yeah, that's the kind of insight we can only get from you. So just want to thank you for all of your time, Vladimir. This has been absolutely incredible, a real honor for me. So really appreciate it. The course is called Thinking in Chess, a How-To Guide, available from Chessable. For if you would like more insights from Grandmaster Kramnik, I definitely recommend it. So thank you so much, Vladimir.
My pleasure. All the best to you and to all people who listen to this podcast.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible, most of all to my producer, Matthew Passy. I also would like to thank everyone who helped spread the word about the show. Did you guys know that there's still people who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast? There's even chess players who have not heard of the Perpetual Chess podcast. So we need to fix that. And the ways to do that include writing positive reviews on podcast platforms or YouTube comments, telling friends, all that stuff makes a difference in helping spread the word about the show. But of course, I most of all want to thank people who provide financial support to the show. Without you all, Perpetual Chess would not be possible. So without further ado, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, David Lazarus of LazmanChess.com, coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, Apprentice Twitch Channel, Aniti Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, ChessMood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Heath, Danny Davidson, David Mitchell, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Farhan Thawar, Barasawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, I am Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jay Garrison, Jeff Martinson, Jeff Schaefer, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kevin Forsyth, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Cell, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, Lucio Casada Silva, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdinays Twitch channel, Grandmaster Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodi, Philip Flummins, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Ross Crossland, Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Steven Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tuchenko, Todd Bryan of StrongChess.com, Todd Kennedy, The Vintage Patsers, which is a Chess.com improver group, Wayne Bean, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovitz, Antonio Cancino, Antonio K. Leonfort, FM Andre Terikov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard, Lynn, Brian, Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Patser Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Kiefer, Chris Wayne Scott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Blaskoczek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Tennis Parrish, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Edwin Rodriguez, Ethan Smith, Evan Rosenberg, Ewan Richardson, Ian Mason, Felipe Melo Padilla, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Francis Letart Lavoir, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Behan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Perry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jaydeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse Zakumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe Dasano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John McAdams, John Tully, Juan Almagar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, WGM Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, Grandmaster Josh Friedel, I am Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, I am Kostya Kravutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Ryforth, Laura Boyovsky, Macaulay Peterson, Maria Emelyanovas, aka PhotoChess, Mark Shaves, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovic, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, the Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Gobel, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Negma Malajanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Blaine, Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited of Switzerland, Randall Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel and publishing empire, Scott McKinnon, Scott Rose, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwalder, Sergey McCagan, Seth Ruzica, Sean Tracy, Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatev Abrahamian, Thomas Brown, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tobiah Rex, Tom Edsel, Tommy Farron, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks to you all for the support, and we will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.